Hi, Patrick Cox here in the World Newsroom in Boston. Today, selling nouns and adjectives to a shoe company, among other great stories from the memoirs of linguist David Crystal. Also, when Nowhereistan becomes Everywhereistan. And Snufkin, Little Mai, and the Snork Maiden, the past, present, and future of the Moomins.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
It's embarrassing when Europeans come over here, they all speak English, and then we go over to Europe, and all we can say is, merci beaucoup.
The World Public Radio program, the show I work for, is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The Big Show is broadcast on more than 280 public radio stations around the United States. You can listen online at theworld.org. That's also where you can check out this and all of our other podcasts. Other places to find this podcast are on Facebook at the World in Words group page. I'm also on Twitter. Today, a linguist looks back at a rich life in language, also a whimsical new nation. And speaking of whimsy, we have Finland's answer to, well, a kind of a blend of Disney, The Simpsons, and Tolkien. Now, if you heard podcast number 58, you heard me play this clip not once, but I think three times. I've also played it at the top of the cast a few times.
Absolute, the biggest load of chicken droppings I've heard in a long time, Jeremy, I have to say.
And now I've done it again, totally gratuitously. I love it. I just can't help it. Now, the man who delivered this great line is David Crystal. His formal title is Honorary Professor of Linguistics at Bangor University in Wales. Informally, he's Britain's best known and best loved linguist. He's just written a memoir. It's called, pun alert, Just a Phrase I'm Going Through, My Life in Language. He was recently on the BBC, one of those roundtable type shows. So at times you'll hear more than just Crystal and the interviewer Libby Purvis. You'll hear a few other people just kind of sniggering in the funny bits and shuffling a little bit in their chairs, stuff like that. Here's Purvis asking David Crystal about that punning title of his book.
It's odd that somebody so interested in meaning as you, an academic, should be into puns. A lot of academics are quite irritated by puns, aren't they?
Well, I think one of the gorgeous things about language is the way in which it's creatively used. That's the whole point. You learn a set of rules and then you mess them up, you know, the best you can. And you mess them up in all sorts of ways. You can go into poetry and look at the clever, creative ways that Shakespeare and others mess with the language, breaking the rules all the time. Shakespeare shows us how to dare with language, really. And punning, some people hate it, some people love it, but it's a very good example of the naturalness of language. There's a story I tell in the book about a group of people sitting round the room, and one person talks about two cats that have met each other. They were new neighbours, and we didn't know whether we were going to get on. And the previous night, the two, our cat and their cat, had met. So one person says, oh, there was a catfrontation last night then. that's where it should stop. But of course, it doesn't stop. And everybody now tries to outdo the other person in terms of producing a better pun. And another person says it's a catastrophe. And another person says, ah, but one of the cats had catarrh. And it goes on and on and on.
It's a delicate matter to discuss.
Absolutely. And we could do it now for the next 20 minutes until...
Let's not.
Until we run out of puns.
A lot of people who are academics and who love language and who have, as you have, done huge studies on Shakespeare and so on, actually get very hoity about things like texting and things like jargon and things like youth speak. You just love it. You hurl yourself into every new variant of language that turns up, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Tomorrow is always another day with language. That's the last words of the book almost. You know, tomorrow is another day. Whatever you've worked out about language today, it's going to be different tomorrow. You mentioned things like text speak. It's so important also to have some people around who look dispassionately at this, because there's a huge mythology out there about text messaging. You know, half the world's population texts now, and people like Barack Obama do it all the time. It isn't just a kid's thing anymore. And when you actually look at text messaging, the myth that's out there is that the abbreviations like, you know, see you later and that sort of thing are there all the time. They're not. Only 10% of the words in text messages are actually abbreviated. It isn't as deviant as you might think.
But do you get irritated by what people call sloppy speech, or indeed by the kids on the bus one here saying, and I'm like, and she's like, as if, and I'm like, what? And she's like, no.
Oh, that's not sloppy.
Do you like that?
Oh, that's not sloppy. That's a perfectly natural way of communicating. I'll tell you what's sloppy. Sloppy is when a professional loses his or her professionalism. Dare I tell an example about the BBC? BBC announcers and presenters have to speak clearly in order to be understood. That's part of the business. And so when a Radio 3 announcer says something like, so that was Symphony No. 3 by... And you say, who? By who? By who? I didn't hear it. And why does it happen? Because the person is looking down away from the microphone to see what's next on the script or whatever it is. But the name is lost in the ether.
That's unprecedented. But how about obfuscatory jargon? Things terrible. Like local authority speak in which the...
Again, it's a lack of professionalism.
A swimming pool becomes a leisure facility.
One of the things about professionals is they must be aware of their audience. They must know who they're talking to and get the level right. And anybody who doesn't get the level right is being unprofessional or being deliberately obfuscating. And that, of course, is where it gets interesting.
The book is full of these fascinating asides and lists and facts, but basically it is an autobiography as well, so we should do some of that. Not entirely an easy childhood, and a father who was physically cut out of family photographs by your mother, you discover. That's a hard thing for a chap, isn't it?
Well, I thought he was dead, absolutely. We had a single-parent family. I looked at other families that had a father in, and I thought, oh, that must be nice. Oh, well, there you go. And she never talked about him, and I just thought he was dead.
And years later, you actually discovered him.
Yeah, I found him about 15, 20 years ago through a whole chain of coincidences. This is an autobiographical memoir. It's called My Life in Language. So I wasn't really going to talk about the personal side so much, except insofar as the language element intervenes. So you don't find in this book whether I like broccoli or not, for example, and all the other things that celeb biographies might have. But I only found my father through my professional life in language, eventually discovering that, yes, he was alive and well, and indeed he had a whole family, all called Crystal, and I know them all now, and we're great friends.
Your discovery of university life is this wonderful sense I get in the book of a round peg finding a round hole, and yes, that's where you need to be. I mean, you're a chap who writes to colleague congratulatory letters on the birth of their children, saying congratulations on the arrival of your new data set.
Oh, absolutely.
Study your children.
Yes. Sorry, is there another reason for having children, Libby? Take me with you.
But the university world has just been the what you swim in, isn't it?
Well, for so long, yes, it was indeed. And the sad thing was that I had to leave it in order to carry on being a writer and a researcher. In order to write the books, I had to leave the university system, and that was really a bit of a wrench, because I did feel I was a round peg in a round hole.
There are thousands of stories, and from that time, just one I long for you to tell is about the shoemaker. I mean, this is a university department getting the most extraordinary request from a shoemaking company. Tell us about that.
This was the Survey of English Usage back in the 1960s. This was the first time the English language was going to be surveyed from the grammar point of view, really accurately. And I was the research assistant on the survey. And one day the phone rings and I pick the phone up, and a voice at the other end says, is that the Survey of English Usage? And I say, yes. And he says, well, we're so-and-so shoe company from the Strand. We've got a new advertising campaign. I wonder, do you have any good adjectives for shoes? And I say, what? And they say, yes, we need some adjectives. Do you sell them? Sell them? Yes. And then I suddenly realise this is a joke. This is a jape. One of my mates is ringing me up. And so I say, oh, yes, sir, of course. Yes, we have excellent adjectives for shoes. They're 12 pence a dozen. And I go on like this. And then I say, I think I'll take him here. We've got a very good line in nouns, too. Nouns are a little cheaper. And verbs. Verbs are very expensive, sir. But for you, I'll do a job lot of 24 verbs for just 10 pence. And some adverbs, sir? You'd like some adverbs, too? And I go on like this. And the guy at the other end says, fine. Thank you very much. Where do I send the invoice? And I say, send it to the Survey of English Usage. And 2 days later, of course, another invoice comes through from this shoe company in the Strand for a dozen adjectives, two dozen nouns, and so on and so forth, £2.17 and sixpence, or whatever it was at the end. And we're all appalled because now we don't know what to do.
So you looked it up and it was a real company?
It was a real company. They were seriously interested in buying adjectives, nouns, verbs and adverbs.
But then you had to find some adjectives for
shoes. Well, we did.
We went to the
thesaurus, we went to Roger's thesaurus, pulled together a big pile of adjectives and everything, sent them off, got a lovely letter a few days later saying, thank you so much, this is really helpful. Mm. And I have to say, when I went past the shoe shop in the Strand a few days later, I thought their language was extremely high quality.
But what's a good shoe adverb? Nimbly. Comfortable.
Oh, no, you have to be much more dramatic than that, Libby. You're succinctly fitting shoes.
David Crystal. His autobiography is Just a Phrase I'm Going Through, My Life in Language. It's currently only available in the UK, but there are many other Crystal books available in the United States, and there's a new one coming out this October. It's called Walking English, A Journey in Search of Language. Did you notice, by the way, how Crystal mispronounced President Obama's first name, as many Brits do? He said Barack Obama. I'm collecting a few examples of this for a future podcast. Just thought I'd throw that one out there. Okay, now for Eating Sideways. This is where we pick a foreign word or a phrase that works best in the original, doesn't easily translate into English, doesn't succinctly translate, to use Crystal's shoe word. Well, this week is a little variation on that theme. We're borrowing a suffix from ancient Persian. At least that's the most widely agreed upon explanation of where this comes from. That suffix is stan, and it means place where one stays. In other words, country or homeland. So it means country if you're talking about Afghanistan or Pakistan or Tajikistan. And it means homeland if you're talking about Waziristan, Dagestan or Kurdistan. There have been lots of jokes about the stans, mainly because so many of them are off the beaten trail. They're a little hard to place geographically. The following, however, is not a joke. It's straight fantasy. Nowheristan. Nowheristan, of course, doesn't exist on any map, but it does exist in the mind of Lebanese businessman Michel Elefriadis. And Elefriadis likes to call himself a citizen of Nowheristan, which is a nation, in his mind, that has it all.
This is the country from where everything started, and we are very happy to have the pyramids, and to have the Louvre, and to have the Statue of Liberty. We have the highest mountain in the world. We have volcanoes, we have the tallest trees, the sequoias. We have everything.
Now, before you draw any conclusions as to the sanity of Mr. Elefriadis, consider the recent history of the real country that he grew up in, Lebanon. Lebanon has always been divided along religious and cultural lines. Both Israel and Syria have invaded and occupied it. Worst of all, there was the brutal civil war of the 1970s and 80s, and Elefriadis' life was changed by that.
The Christian militias during the Lebanese war arrested me. Being tortured at that age of 15 is not something very easy to swallow. And I started being more and more involved in politics to take my revenge on the militias. And they killed a lot of my friends. And this is when I understood that maybe what I'm doing is not the right way. So we have to change everything. We have to create a world where such things cannot happen. We have to stop working on nationalism, working on the idea that everyone who's not my compatriot is different from me. So we have to realize that it's not racial or religious things that make us close. It's much more ideas, it's much more personal, very personal things like humor. People have to realize that an American can be best friend with a Chinese and maybe not get along at all with his neighbor.
Elefriadis has started an NGO that'll teach young people that message, also encourage them to use nonviolent means to achieve the goals of inclusiveness. Meanwhile, back in the real world, well, let's stay in the ideal world of Nowheristan just for 1 minute. Guess who's proclaimed himself the ruler of Nowheristan? Yep.
I'm the first and last emperor of Nowheristan.
First and last? As in for life? And did he say emperor? Uh-oh. And just how large will this empire be?
The entire planet will be inhabited by Nowheristanis. We will change the name to Everywheristan.
Okay, as a mind exercise, that's not bad, even if the mind is where it'll stay. And Everywheristan is a great coinage. When he's not running the planet, by the way, Michel Elefriadis runs a nightclub in Beirut. For the next 3 weeks or so, I'm going to do a little mini-series on children's books. First up are the Moomins, straight out of Finland. And they're much bigger there and elsewhere than here in the United States. And there's a lot of elsewhere, too. The Moomins have been translated into more than 30 languages. A couple of things to mention here before I hit the play button. One is, there is a mistake in this story, and it's language-related. It's one of those things that you'll either recognize immediately or not at all. I'll fill you in at the end. Also, I direct listeners early on in this story to the world's homepage for an image of the Moomins. Well, that was for our Big Show listeners when this report originally aired. The images aren't up on the page anymore, but there are plenty of other places online to find great pictures of the Moomins. Again, details in a few minutes. One last thing. I am a big Moomin fan. There, I've said it. I feel better now. Now, I can play you this. There's something about Europe's northern edge that seems to inspire people to dream up full-blown fantasy worlds. You have the Norse myths, the stories of Hans Christian Andersen, and the Moomins. Moomins look like, well, if you're near a computer, go to theworld.org to see what the Moomins look like. I can't do them justice, except to say that they look a bit like a cross between humans and hippos. Moomins share their alternate reality with, among others, Hemulins, Niblings, and a love interest called the Snork Maiden. From Argentina to Russia, children and their parents love the Moomins.
People want to name their boats, their children after the Moomins, and build Moomin houses to live in, and all sorts of things.
Sophia Janssen is the niece of the late Tove Janssen. In the 1940s, Tove Janssen wrote and illustrated Moomin adventure stories. In the 50s, she drew a comic strip with the same characters. The strip has just been published in the US in book form. But it was in the 1960s that Moomin mania began in earnest.
There were television series made, operas, theatre plays, and a big breakthrough was the latest Moomin animation.
Yep, that's Japanese anime. The Moomins are massive in Japan. This cartoon is merely the latest Japanese attempt to adapt the Moomins for TV. The first time anime producers tried it, Tove Janssen was not happy.
They had put a lot of elements into the stories that were not there to begin with, sort of fighting and violence and weapons and stuff. So she was quite horrified and she forbade them to show it outside of Japan.
Later adaptations, in Japan and elsewhere, hew closer to Janssen's original stories and to their sometimes cozy, sometimes surreal tone.
Moomin Troll couldn't decide where to hide. Then he caught sight of the tall black hat. What a brilliant idea. Poor Moomin Troll. He didn't know that whatever stayed in the Hobgoblin's hat long enough changed into something quite different.
I always thought perhaps there was something un-American about the Moomins.
Moomin aficionada Shelley Jackson, herself the author of otherworldly fiction, can't put her finger on why it is Americans generally don't do Moomin. There are theories. The loose morals of the characters, the ambiguous family relationships, the unrelenting weirdness of their world. Whatever the reason, Jackson says, her fellow Americans are missing out on a fabulously accurate portrayal of children's needs and fears.
I think it makes sense for how kids really feel in the world, that obviously they need to be protected, but they also absolutely need to go beyond that protection. Otherwise, they never are going to be people at all. So there has to be this pull in both directions.
Over the generations, kids around the world appear to have sensed this in the Moomin stories, so much so that there's now an industry of Moomin toys, trinkets, and clothes. In Finland, the Moomins are a Disney-like brand. There's a Moomin theme park, Moomin candy, even Moomin baby wipes. Not that it helps US-based fan Shelley Jackson.
It's hard to get this stuff. You have to pay through the nose for it on eBay. And most of it's from Japan. I don't know why, but there's not that much of the Finnish stuff available.
Meantime, the Finns now identify Moomin characters such as Snufkin and Little Mai as national mascots. The less reverent members of the Finnish news media refer to the country's president as Moomin Mama, because she always carries a purse and tries to sort out everyone's problems. And if you're wondering whether Hollywood has ever pursued a Moomin project, the answer is yes, several times. But Tove Janssen's heirs don't want the Moomins messed with, and have so far resisted. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox. Here's something I've come across since I reported that story. It's a version of the Moomins for American kids.
Here they are for one and all. The Moomins are about to call. Come on and sit down here with me. They're here for you on your TV. They are the Moomins. They are the Moomins. So come with me.
This American version seems infantilized and cutified, which just made it too much like all the other stuff on TV. It lost its Moominess.
Oh, hello, Moomin.
It's really good to see you, Snufkin.
And you too.
You're back early. Weren't you having a good time?
Yes, I was. But I didn't want to miss springtime in Moomin Valley.
What did you do?
I'll tell you later. Let's go wake up Sniff and think of something exciting to do.
American Moomins. They never took off. So, did you get the not-so-deliberate mistake? It was when I played the excerpt from the Moomin anime near the beginning of the story. The anime, the cartoon, is Japanese. But the language in the version I played was Cantonese. The Moomins had spread from one country to another in Asia, just like the comic strip and the stories had done in Europe. I guess I could have argued that technically I was correct, that I was describing the cartoon as Japanese. But no, I was really describing the cartoon and the language. And I'm big enough to say I was wrong. Maybe small enough too. In fact, I really enjoy pointing out when I've made an error. There's something quite uplifting about it. So be sure to let me know if you spot something in any of the podcasts that I do. I'll post a couple of Moomin links with images at the World in Words Facebook page, also at patrickcox.wordpress.com, and finally at the Big Show site, go to theworld.org/language. Okay, that's enough Moomins, maybe for a lifetime for some of you, and that's enough of this podcast. Until next week, that is. Talk to you then. Bye. Do-dee-do-dee-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee-dum-dum-do-dee-red-lo-dee